4, Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. South Korean President Moon Jae-in held a surprise meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to exchange views on how to prepare for the North's possible summit with President Trump, who recently canceled the June 12th meeting. Mr. Trump said he canceled the planned talks with Kim, blaming recent threatening statements by Pyongyang to pull out of the summit over what it saw as confrontational remarks by U.S. officials. Later, the president indicated the summit might still take place next month because Washington and Pyongyang are communicating. An American who had been held as prisoner in Venezuela since the summer of 2016 is back in the United States. Joshua Holt and his Venezuelan wife and daughter arrived accompanied by Senator Bob Corker, who helped negotiate their release. Then they met at the White House with President Trump.
We have Josh Holt and his wife Tammy, and they came back from a very tough ordeal in a Venezuelan prison, almost 2 years, Josh. And, amazing that you were able to take it. Your daughter, Marion's here, and your parents.
Holt and his wife had been imprisoned in Venezuela for 2 years on charges of concealing weapons, a charge they deny. A shootout in Pakistan's southwestern Quetta City on Sunday evening left two police officers and two militants dead, according to officials. The incident occurred around sunset when two gunmen riding a motorcycle opened fire, killing two traffic police. Officers on patrol nearby heard the gunshots and rushed to the scene. One officer said that another militant on a separate motorcycle was wounded in the clashes before leaving the scene. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. A suicide bomber has detonated his explosives-laden truck near an army base in southern Afghanistan, killing at least 8 soldiers and wounding around a dozen more. The Taliban swiftly took responsibility for carrying out the bombing. An insurgent spokesman claimed the powerful blast killed and wounded more than 100. Afghan officials said Sunday's deadly blast took place in an area government forces recently freed from insurgent control. The Palestinian Health Ministry says two Palestinians were killed in the southern Gaza Strip Sunday by Israeli tank fire. Israel says the tank fire happened as its troops were detonating an explosive device that had been placed near the border fence. Israel said in a statement that the charge was placed last night near the border fence in the southern Gaza Strip in an attempt to harm forces operating in the area and was neutralized this morning by IDF troops. At least 118 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli fire in the Gaza Strip since mass protests and clashes broke out in March. 4 Russian servicemen have been killed by militant fire in Syria. 5 other soldiers were wounded in the incident in Syria's eastern province, according to the ministry, when several mobile terrorist groups attacked a Syrian government artillery position that night. The ministry said the Russian casualties were military advisors to the Syrian troops. The statement did not say when the fighting took place or occurred, although several reports suggest it may have taken place last Wednesday. As health officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo treat the number of people showing up in clinics with symptoms of Ebola, 3 patients escaped from a hospital. 2 of them died the very next day. Reuters' Aaron Ross has more.
This is extremely concerning, especially because the fact that they died so shortly thereafter means that they were extremely contagious to those around them. And so, you know, health workers worked very quickly to identify all the contacts, the people they came into contact with, to vaccinate some of those people and further trace any additional contacts that may have taken place.
And with more than twice as many Ebola outbreaks as any other country since the virus was discovered in 1976, the people of the Congo area are familiar with Ebola's destructive power, yet they fear and have suspicion of medical authorities. Experts say this is contributing to the difficulties in containing the spread of the disease. Irish citizens have voted by a large margin to repeal the country's restrictive abortion law. Ireland's health minister, Simon Harris, says there were a lot of tears of relief when the referendum passed.
It's not celebration in the marriage equality sense. Termination is never a cause for celebration. No woman ever wants to find themselves in that situation. But it is certainly relief that Ireland has voted to be a more compassionate place.
The vote eliminates a 1983 amendment that required authorities to defend the lives of woman and a fetus equally. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The government only benefited 1.1% from minerals exported out of the country because most of the mining companies did not pay corporation tax or claimed loss.
Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio seeks to ensure transparency in the country's mining sector.
We really welcome these pledges and we hope and pray that the pledges will be fulfilled as soon as possible. And if that happens, then the government will be in a position to implement all the projects.
Gambian President Adama Barrow promises to give 10% of his salary to the country's national development plan.
I get surprised when Mugabe complains that he's being harassed, when we know that he built his empire on corruptive behavior and very dicey, you know, business deals, and he's a free man.
And former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe says he feels unsafe because the government is spying on him. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leonean Information Minister says President Julius Maada Bio is committed to implementing policies to ensure transparency in the mining sector. Mohamed Rado Suare says Sierra Leoneans have lost millions of dollars needed to improve the lives of citizens due to what he says has been the lack of transparency in the mining industry. His remarks came after President Julius Maada Bio told lawmakers that there is need for a speedy review of the 2009 Mines and Minerals Act and the individual licenses of mining companies. He said the previous government did not do enough to ensure the country benefited from its natural resources. To learn more, I reach Information Minister Mohamed Rado Suare in the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown.
The mining sector is a very important sector in our country. Some time ago, it contributed something like 24% to GDP. But over the years, it's been subject to a lot of fluctuations because of volatility in the extractive industry, commodity prices on the world market. But it still remains a very major contributor in our national development. But in the past, it's been riddled with a lot of corruption, absence of transparency, weak institutional capacity, and a lot more. So during the campaign, His Excellency President Bio made it a major manifesto commitment to provide an efficient political and economic management of our mineral resources. So specifically, we intend to review the Mines and Minerals Act of 2009 to realign it with the mining policy and international best practice. We also intend as a government to review the relevant laws and legislation to establish a natural resource account, you know, to which we will deposit all proceeds from the extractive industry.
There are some concerns that it appears the government could use this process to go after their political enemies in a persecuting move. What do you say to that?
No. Anybody who has had an intimate knowledge of Brigadier Bio's long journey to the presidency knows that he's not a vindictive, ambitious person. During the 2012 campaign, he got stoned in bone. He had a head injury. You know, he has been president. He is not on a witch hunt. He has said he's not on a revenge mission. He has a huge and disastrous and task to build a battered and shattered country. That is our focus. We are not going to allow any distraction. However, that is not going to. We are not going to sacrifice accountability and transparency on the altar of such blackmail. That taking action against people who have committed economic and other crimes against Sierra Leone is, you know, witch hunt.
What do you say to critics who say that the president recently said that there's an extreme lack of transparency in the mining sector under his predecessor, Ernest Bai Koroma? Some are saying that this latest move is to make the former president look bad and the former ruling APC party look unattractive.
No, I mean, we don't have to make any extra effort to make the APC unattractive. I mean, voters already demonstrated that at the polls by overwhelmingly voting the SLPP of Brigadier Bio into governance. The facts of the matter are there for all to see. The past government enacted 99-year lease concessions, operations of the mining and mineral sector have been completely opaque, have complete absence of transparency, which really does not engender a lot of trust, even within mining communities and between the mining companies and the government. You have recently a civil society group published a book, Not Sharing the Loot. There are very startling revelations in that document, including the fact that government only benefited 1.1% from minerals exported out of the country, because most of the mining companies did not pay corporation tax or claimed loss. That is not good for a country that has been largely dependent on the sector. We also have a situation where there have been, very frivolous duty waivers issued to mining companies, and so the state has had little or nothing or very little to benefit at all. So this is not a chance. This is the reality of the situation, and we believe Sierra Leoneans deserve better from their God-given mineral resources.
Does this new plan that the president wants to implement include legislation to consolidate all mining revenues into a single account from which funds could be allocated to what the government wants to be done?
Well, this is very simple. They might have alternative views about what to do, but I could imagine that a loyal opposition has the best interest of the country at heart. Like I said before, we will review the relevant legislation to ensure that we establish a natural resource account into which we will put all proceeds from the extractive industry. We will also ensure that a percentage of revenue from the mining sector is disbursed to education, to health, and greater beneficiation schemes for mining communities. And that is very important for us. We also have in place a policy where we want to ensure that we put the necessary policies and mechanisms in place to ensure that necessary value additions are done to this mineral so that we can generate more jobs and put more money into the pockets of Sierra Leone.
Mohamed Rado Soare is the Sierra Leone Information Minister. He spoke with me from Freetown. Gambian President Adama Barrow has promised to give 10% of his salary to the country's national development plan. The announcement followed the return of the president to a donor conference in Belgium. Donors at the summit pledged $1.7 billion to help with efforts by the administration in Banjul to develop the West African country. The administration says the pledges would help the Gambia recover from the lack of development during the years under the government of Yahya Jammeh, the former longtime president of the Gambia, who is now exiled in Equatorial Guinea. To learn more about President Barrow's salary pledge, I reach information Minister Demba Ali Jawo in the Gambian capital, Banjul.
He was leading a delegation to Brussels, where there was an external conference for the Gambia, and the European Union and other international donors made some pledge of money to the Gambia. And, when he came back, he also made a pledge that he was going to donate 10% of his salary, of course, the end of June. And the rationale behind is that because he has seen the international community has a lot of goodwill towards the Gambia, and they have pledged a lot of money to help us in our development program. And he thought probably as Gambians we also should be seen to be doing something, not only waiting for the international donors to help us with something. That is the rationale for his pledge.
I understand $1.7 billion worth of pledges were made. How soon will the Gambia see these funds transferred to the country for its developmental projects?
Well, we are expecting those who have made the pledges to honor their pledges as soon as possible. Although we are not in a position right now to determine exactly as to when they're going to do that. But we are hoping, that they will do so as soon as possible.
Some critics of the president are saying that donating 10% of his salary when everything of his is being taken care of by the state doesn't go far enough. Do you think this criticism is justified?
No, I don't think it is justified. He could have, just like everybody else, not pledged anything and then continue to receive whatever is receiving from the public money. But he decided that at least something needs to be done on that side. And he made the pledge. I mean, nobody actually compelled him to do that. So I don't think that such criticism is justified. You know, he has shown the goodwill and he has done it.
What is the target of the National Development Plan of the Gambia?
The target we got what we call the page 2. That is another long-term plan, you know, which is already in place. But the target of the National Development Plan is a short-term thing from 2018 to 2021. It is a kind of a stopgap measure to take care of the most urgent developmental needs of the country, you know. So, and it is to one for some of the areas that we want to tackle very, very urgently is institutional reform. As you know, we inherited a broken economy. Virtually all the state institutions were in complete disarray, and you know, we need to tackle all those things. And also other short-term development plans. I mean, we need to urgently take care of a lot of things which have been broken. We found that we are in complete disarray.
Some Gambians are saying that the government seemed to be going too slow with some of its projects and promises, and that there's need for the processes to be expedited. What do you make of the assessment? Do you think that the expectations are too high?
Yes, I think the expectations of the people are too high compared to what the capacity of the government. As I told you, I mean, we inherited a broken economy, and the government has a lot of objectives in doing things, but the capacity is extremely low. So, you know, I mean, people need to be a little bit patient with us. Things don't move as fast as we would have loved it to be because the capacity is low.
What do you tell the Gambians following this $1.7 billion of pledges that were made to the president and the people of the Gambia at the Brussels Donor Summit?
All we can tell them is that, I mean, we really welcome these pledges and we hope and pray that the pledges will be fulfilled as soon as possible. And if that happens, then the government will be in a position to implement all the projects and the plans that we have under the National Development Plan and other aspects of our program that we have lined up to develop this country.
Demba Ali Jawo is the Gambian Information Minister. He spoke with me from Banjul. Former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe has expressed concern he does not feel safe, adding that the government is spying on him. During a meeting at his residence in the capital, Harare, the former president told the visiting Equatorial Guinean President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbazogo that the government is sabotaging his family's businesses' interests. Local media reports say the Equatorial Guinean leader was in Zimbabwe to find out how the former president was doing after the military forced him to step down. To learn more about Mugabe's complaint, I read Rejoice Ngwenya, a Zimbabwean political analyst.
Well, my first instinct really is that Mugabe is a complacent, grumpy old man. Look, every time some old dictator friend of his visits, either from the AU or from any part of Africa, he takes that opportunity to complain. He's got a lot of litany of complaints. I think really, like he was told yesterday, he should be grateful that he came out of this alive, because this was a pretty violent, takeover, and he now needs to start counting his blessing. All people usually do complain about one thing or another, but I think for Mugabe, he's got a good reason to be suspicious, because he's developed a system that is used to oppressing people, so he must be hiding something then.
He said he feels unsafe and that it appears the administration is targeting his family and business interests. What do you say to that?
Emmerson Mnangagwa has been on a national campaign talking about how peaceful he is, how he doesn't carry grudges, and one of the most valid complaints that we have heard against him as citizens is that all his promises and threats to deal with the corruption, no conviction has been made yet. So I get surprised when Mugabe complains that he's being harassed, when we know that he built his empire on corruptive behavior and very dicey, you know, business deals, and he's a free man. So we cannot be talking about Kushungu Holdings, because Kushungu Holdings is controlled by Grace, and Grace Mugabe, you know, is very notorious for dirty deals. So this is the last man who should be complaining about being harassed, because we know that his empire has been built on very dicey circumstances.
How are people reacting to President Mnangagwa's reconciliation efforts, trying to get into the good graces of his former boss?
Well, there are different camps, really, and but there are basically two distinct camps. One camp that is definitely very vengeful, that wanted to see this old man incarcerated and being locked up for the so-called crimes, economic and political, that he committed. Really, he led a very brutal, you know, 37-year, you know, old term of governance. And my personal opinion, Red, is that this man belongs to prison. But there are those that believe that bygones are bygones, and they are really congratulating Emmerson Mnangagwa for extending a hand of conciliation. And come to think of it, Red, you know, we didn't really come out of a typical coup scenario where there was violence and all. So I really believe that these two sides can be reconciled, and just perhaps a couple of millions of Zimbabweans are beginning to believe Emmerson Mnangagwa's story of extending ahead of conciliation. This is why even Servius Kasokwere, who just jetted in a couple of days ago, did not face any justice, because it's part of that mentality and predisposition towards reconciliation.
Some people are suggesting that perhaps the reconciliation gesture being offered by Emmerson Mnangagwa is rooted in the fact that Zimbabwe will be having elections very soon in July, and that reuniting or pulling President Robert Mugabe together could positively impact on the fortunes of the ZANU-PF in the upcoming elections. What is your take?
Well, it's a bit too late now, because remember that, you know, one reason why Mnangagwa has risen, a good motive to be spying on the old man, is that the old man seems to be associated with the National Patriotic Front, which basically are remnant ZANU-PF elements that have formed some political outfit. So for Mnangagwa to try and extend roads to Mugabe now would really have very little bearing on his electoral potency. Because most ZANU-PF people, ex-ZANU-PF people that did not agree with the coup will naturally vote against him. So perhaps he just has to be content that he's dealing with a political competitor who is pretending to be aggrieved.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. The military tribunal in Yaoundé has given jail sentences of 10 to 15 years to seven English-speaking detainees in connection with the unrest that has paralyzed business in the English-speaking zones of the Central African nation. Among them is radio host Mancho Bibixi, the leader of the so-called Coffin Revolution, who used an open casket in street demonstrations calling for better conditions for the poor. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka followed the night court session and reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
It was at about 8 p.m. Central African time that this roll call of seven English-speaking Cameroonian activists, including radio host Mancho Bibixi, was made at the military tribunal in Yaoundé. The activists, defense attorneys, and observers had been at the tribunal for 4 hours awaiting sentencing. The suspects had been arrested separately in November 2016 and charged with conspiracy to terrorism, rebellion against the state, incitement of civil unrest, breach of the constitution, provoking civil war by inciting the people to take arms against each other, and propagation of false information. Shortly after the roll call, T. Conrad, one of the activists, demanded that the presiding judge announce their sentences and stop wasting time. Mancho Bibikse said he had expected a death sentence and added that all English-speaking detainees were threatened on a daily basis by prison workers. The suspects were given sentences ranging from 10 to 15 years and ordered to pay a fine of $500,000 as damages to the civil parties, including the state of Cameroon. They will each also have to pay the sum of $10,000 or spend additional 2 years in jail. Emmanuel Sim, one of the lead defense attorneys, said they would be filing an appeal. Among the activists are two radio personalities. Journalist Thomas Awa Jr. was given an 11-year jail term, but the crowd puller during the court session was Mancho Bibikse, a Bamenda-based radio host and Anglophone activist. He was accused of threatening Cameroon's sovereignty when he appeared in a coffin at a protest in the northwestern town of Bamenda in November 2016, saying his coffin was symbolic of Anglophone Cameroonians who seemed to have died before their real death and who therefore should not fear speaking truth to power. Some people are asking for a return to a federal state Cameroon had practiced for about a dozen years after its 1960 independence. Some are asking for the independence of the English-speaking from the French-speaking regions of Cameroon. But President Paul Biya has repeated on several occasions that national unity is not for negotiation. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The World Health Organization's annual conference has ended on a high note, with the organization's Director General praising delegates for giving him a strong mandate to implement an ambitious program of reforms and initiatives that will improve global health. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus wrapped up his first World Health Assembly by paying homage to his predecessor, Margaret Chan. He says the reforms begun under her leadership to make the World Health Organization more responsive and better able to tackle emergencies are now paying off.
The current Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo has demonstrated exactly that. Let me assure you that I am personally committed to ensuring that we do everything we can to stop this outbreak as soon as possible. And the commitment of the government, of course, and the leadership is at the center, which we really admire.
The World Health Assembly, the decision-making body of the WHO, has passed a number of resolutions aimed at improving global health. Some deal with diseases that have plagued humanity for centuries, while others are newly emerging. But all these decisions, says Tedros, involve commitments to make the world a healthier, safer place. For example, he notes the Assembly has approved a roadmap to reduce deaths from cholera by 90% by 2030.
You endorsed our 5-year strategic plan on polio transition to strengthen country health systems that could be affected by the scaling down of the Global Polio Eradication Initiative. You passed resolutions on tuberculosis and non-communicable diseases, and you have agreed to increase the development and use of digital technologies to improve health and keep the world safe.
WHO Chief Tedros urged the delegates to go back to their countries with renewed determination to work every day for the health of their people. How well they succeed in this endeavor, he says, will be measured by the outcomes, by whether they result in real change on the ground. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
La la la. Tunajitahidi sana, wala siku mbisha labda, ila kinachochanganya hakuna mbia kabla. Tena nakupa maua peleke, usijiatupa naomba wayapoke. Ah, nasuna mtafunga usiku ni waonge.
Baby. When I work it.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The International Criminal Court, ICC, is now being put to a litmus test to demonstrate that its inordinate concentration on the African continent is not due to the fact that many African states are weak and are not capable of an effective pushback. The ICC has always argued that its concentration on the African continent is due to the fact that many of the African cases brought to the ICC were brought by African states themselves. African critics have always argued that prosecutorial discretion requires that the chief prosecutor should not bring all cases brought to it to the ICC's tribunal. Now we have a situation where the foreign minister of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO, has formally approached the chief prosecutor of the ICC to take on a case against Israel on the alleged crime against humanity and its policy in the West Bank of the Jordan settlement policy and its treatment of Palestinians there, as well as the recent incidents in the Gaza Strip. Now, the chief prosecutor has been arguing since 2017 that the ICC has made enormous progress to investigate Israeli policy in the West Bank and Gaza. No one knows what that means. But now the international community will see whether the ICC has the stamina and the courage to truly take on Israel. All of those who are familiar with the Israeli government's policy knows that Israel always rejects any investigation by international institutions on the grounds that they are biased against the state of Israel. This is why Israel has consistently demonized the United Nations Security Council as well as the General Assembly. Now, the Israel Supreme Court last week also ruled that the killings by Israeli troops in the Gaza Strip were in accordance with the law. So one wonders how Israel is going to react if the chief prosecutor truly wants to investigate the state of Israel. And if the ICC fails to pursue this to its lawful end, then Africans will hold firm to the view that the ICC has been biased against the African continent and cannot dare to go on to other countries around the world where you have not only excessive use of force and atrocities, but you have also corruption. So this is a major case that the world will be watching very closely to see. Now, Israel, when the PLO acceded to the Rome Treaty, warned that the PLO will be playing politics with the ICC. And already, the government of Israel has been saying that the approach of the PLO is on a political grounds. But this is all for the press. What Africa needs to see now is what is the role of the ICC in dealing with the case of Israel. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if you haven't been to two marketplaces, you don't know which the best value is. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, some 815 million people suffer chronically from hunger. And although this is significantly fewer people than the numbers we saw a decade ago, hunger still kills more people than AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. On May 28th, we observe World Hunger Day. It is an effort to focus attention on the fact that despite a sufficient availability of food nearly everywhere, globally some 21,000 people die every day from hunger or malnutrition. People do not go hungry because the world does not produce enough food for everyone. According to the World Hunger Education Service, over the past three decades, significant growth in food production, along with improved access to food, helped reduce the percentage of chronically undernourished people in developing countries from 34% to 15%. The principal problem is that many people in the world still do not have resources to purchase or grow enough food. Indeed, hunger is a consequence of poverty and also one of its causes. Hunger exists because many countries lack social safety nets, because in many countries women, although they do most of the farming, do not have as much access as men to training, credit, or land. Conflict, governance systems that do not encourage investment in agriculture, poor management of land and natural resources, lack of educational opportunity, displacement of small farmers by natural disasters, and financial and economic crises that eliminate jobs at the lowest levels all contribute toward creating conditions that push the poorest into hunger. Over the past decade, a global push to reduce hunger and extreme poverty has marked some significant successes, thanks in part to the efforts of numerous international and transnational institutions, foundations, NGOs, and governments, including the United States. But on World Hunger Day, let us not forget that with over 815,000 people still living in daily food insecurity, we still have a long way to go before we can safely say that no child goes to bed hungry most nights, that no parent skimps on their own dinner so that children can eat.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.